This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Welcome, everyone, to Practical for Your Practice. I am here today with my co-host extraordinaire, Dr. Kevin Holloway. How are you doing, Kevin?
Great. How are you doing, Jenna? You didn't introduce yourself.
Thank you. And I am Jenna. Thank you. Jenna Ermold here, Practical for Your Practice. You know why I didn't introduce myself?
Why's that?
Kevin, I'm kind of having a little bit of a fangirl moment. Ooh. Where I'm so excited about our guest that I am just, you know, kind of bubbly and, you know, maybe not remembering things like my name. So
I was going to say, I rarely see you like this. This is exciting.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited. Well, I'm excited for a couple of reasons. One is I'm a fan of her research. And two, she's Australian. And this means that we get to hear a beautiful Australian accent for the next however long that we chat.
I love that.
And that makes me happy, too.
Well, I think that also makes the podcast international, which this may be the first time, which is awesome, too.
Yes, I believe you are our first international guest, although we do have listeners in Australia. So
we just found that out.
Anyway, without further ado, let me introduce our guest for today is Carolyn Heward, who is a lecturer in clinical psychology at the James Cook University in Australia. Welcome to Practical for Your Practice,
welcome.
Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Jenna and Kevin. What a beautiful welcome. I'm sort of sitting here blushing a little bit. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
Well, and a huge thank you to you, because for the listeners out there, it took us a minute to figure out we're in Colorado and DC and she's in Australia. When can we start the podcast? So for poor Carolyn, she's sipping some coffee at 7 a.m. So we appreciate you waking up and joining us. Would you mind giving us just a brief bio, a little bit about who you are for our listeners?
Absolutely, happy to. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and most of my clinical work has been working with the Australian Defence Force, and I'm sure we'll get to that shortly. Currently, though, I work as a lecturer in clinical psychology at James Cook University, and we're located in Townsville, which is in sort of North Queensland in Australia, so hot, sunny most of the year, but we're also a garrison city. So very much military has been a big part of, you know, sort of who I am and the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'll tell you, I have about a foot of snow outside. So very, very different landscape.
You might even say opposite sides of the globe, right?
Absolutely.
Very opposite. So, you know, today what we're going to talk about is we're going to explore the complexity of military culture's impact on military identity and its effect on mental health in just 25 minutes. So a very, very, you know, extremely interesting topic, one that 25 minutes is surely not enough time. And this is why I'm fangirling, because Kevin always makes fun of me. I'm a military culture geek. I really enjoy talking about it and thinking about it. I'm former Air Force myself. You know, wrote a fantastic paper that we're going to talk about. And I think maybe, our first question would be, how did you get interested in this idea of exploring military culture and military identity and mental health? What's the sort of origin story to that line of research?
One thing I realized I should have said, Jenna, before we started, is some of my clinical work was with the Department of Defence in Australia, and I was also a contracted health provider to Defence for quite some time. And so a lot of my interest came from that area, but I do also want to make it very clear that nothing that I'm saying represents their views. This is purely based on firstly, my observations, which I'll probably talk about in a second, but really importantly, the research, it doesn't represent their view. So I did mean to say that.
No, good, good, good.
Absolutely. Thank you for adding that disclaimer.
So in answer to your question, as far as what got me interested in this, I guess, as I said, I grew up in a garrison town, so Army is a massive presence here in Townsville. We do also have an Air Force base as well. And so I guess that was something that was just, it was part of my water. It was part of what I existed in. But I guess beyond that, early following my clinical training, I worked as a rehabilitation consultant. And one of my biggest client groups was an Army unit here in Townsville. And I guess from that, I found out how much I enjoyed working with this population. And so, even though that was still in a different role to working as a psychologist, it really opened up this interest. And so, when an opportunity came to join our regional mental health team in the Australian Defence Force, I jumped at it. And so, I was successful and I played a couple of roles in that. First, I was the alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs coordinator. And then I took on the senior mental health professional role. And so I guess that I was always looking for ways in which I could be aligned with the military. The other thing that I think is important to acknowledge is that my journey through this, I've always been a civilian. So I've worked alongside the military, but I myself have never served. And so I guess that, as I was saying, the opportunity to work within the Defence Force and to work alongside our units, our soldiers, was just something that I was really drawn to. And so for a long period of time, then I worked in a variety of roles that allowed me to do that. Worked at a trauma recovery centre where our primary client group were military members, current and ex-serving. And so I found that really interesting. And so I guess through my clinical work, I started to observe patterns of culture and identity and the impacts that this had on mental health. And perhaps because I started in rehabilitation and because the military is such a doing culture, you know, they're a doing organization. So when members can't do their role, it really impacts on their mental health. And I guess some of the hypothesis was that perhaps part of that is because of the impact on identity. And so that's probably where I first developed that interest. And then more recently, if you'd like me to tell you, it shifted as far as my PhD study. So I'm currently a PhD candidate. But essentially, where that came from is I was invited to be a member on a representative group that was preparing a submission for our very recent Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicides. So I'm not sure if for your listeners they're aware of that, but Australia very recently, and the findings have only very recently been handed down. But in preparing that submission, we were discussing the high rates of mental health and the high rates of suicide, particularly for our ex-serving members. And something that was presenting as a key hypothesis was that it was the loss of identity upon leaving the military that was a contributing factor. And we were having an interesting conversation around some of the statistics that suggested that for those members who hadn't served for a particularly long time, that they were at quite high risk of mental health problems and suicide. And I recall one of my colleagues sort of making the statement that they were surprised about that because they didn't think that they had long enough to form a military identity. They hadn't
Like there's
been
a
in long
dose,
enough.
like a dose is required, a certain dose to get that.
Yeah, and I guess I found I had a really strong emotive reaction to that, and you know, almost a bit argumentative. And I found myself kind of essentially arguing that, in my opinion at least, I didn't think that was the case, that I thought identity was actually formed reasonably quickly. And so, being
Interesting.
a psychologist, being a practitioner of the you know, scientist practitioner model, I thought, oh, well, actually, what does the research say about this?
Show us the data, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so essentially, that got me really interested in the fact that it seems we don't have a lot of research around the construction of identity, particularly in the Australian Defence Force. And so I guess my point is that if we can't understand how something's constructed, how can we understand its deconstruction?
Yeah.
I love
Yeah,
that.
so that's kind of the roundabout journey of what got me interested in military identity, military culture, and mental health.
It's so fascinating. And I resonate with so much of what you're saying because similarly, like my whole career has been working with military and veteran populations, although I haven't served myself. So I haven't served in active duty position, but did my internship in a VA hospital and been working with the US Army and related agencies since then. And I mean, yeah, you develop that appreciation, that respect, and that love for this population pretty quickly, I think. And then kind of the other thing that you were saying that I wonder if you could elucidate for us a little more, clarify a little bit. We talk a lot, Jenna's already kind of introduced us, we talk a lot about military culture and the importance for therapists to be culturally competent, to understand aspects of military culture in order to best serve those that they're working with. And you're talking about the development of military identity and maybe how that connects to other aspects of their identity. And I wonder if you could describe for us a little bit about what's the distinction between military culture and military identity. How do they work together? Most of my career, we've talked mostly about military culture and not a lot about military identity. And that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think that what we find is sometimes those terms also might be used
Right.
interchangeably.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. Like, cultural safety is critical, and it's a big area that I'm certainly interested in. And so I guess, culture's these complex systems. They have shared beliefs and values. There's behavioral practices. There's the knowledge, the traditions, the social institutions. And then there's also the material things that make up a culture. And
Yeah.
so when you think about the military, it's like, well, of course the military is a culture. You think about the specific language, the
Right.
dress, the rituals, the values, the beliefs, the shared way of doing things and understanding things. And so the military culture is its own subculture, existing within whatever other cultures that we
Right,
all
right.
hold. And so that intersectionality is key. But the thing that I've always really enjoyed, Kevin, and as you said, like working with the military population, is that sense that although you're an outsider, you can work your way to being in that accepted space.
Yes,
And
yeah.
and I love that. And so feeling as if you're part of a culture that is so salient, it isn't a secondary culture to an individual. And that's probably where we transition into that identity space. And so I guess, identity is often a very personal thing. It's often about our beliefs, our experiences, our expectations. But the other key thing about identity is the social component. And so I think this is where the research around social identity theory, even just for a simplistic understanding, really assists us to appreciate just how much individuals understand themselves in relation to, and we say social groups, but what I mean there is by how they understand themselves in relation to that military culture, to their military groups. And some of that, of course, might be rank, it might be corps, it might be service, but it's also the broader sort of military institution. And so I guess, culture's that context that shapes identity. So that's how I see that interplay between the two.
Yeah, so kind of group level culture, that this is that structure, all those pieces, those facets you mentioned, and then the identity being how that individual sees themselves and perhaps within that culture, that in what ways do they align with that culture, or in what ways do they feel like they don't, perhaps, or how that changes over time, I guess, too.
And that's a great segue because that was one of the things I found so helpful There's a figure in your paper that just kind of depicts it beautifully, but all the different categories of identity, some of which really align with military culture very well, like the loyal identity, the warrior identity, and then this notion of hidden identities that, and I wondered if you can kind of speak about those categories, and I know the disrupted identities too, sort of how like what. Because then we're going to sort of segue into mental health, but not everybody aligns perfectly with military culture. And as you said, with intersectionality, we're multifaceted humans, right? And we have these different characteristics and things that are really important to us, some of which really flow with military culture, some of which kind of push against it a little bit, and that has an impact on how identity is formed. So what was interesting to you about all those different sort of types of identities as you looked across the research?
Yeah, I think what was really interesting is I find so much in, certainly in Australia, where when we were talking about that loss of identity, it gets spoken as if it's the loss of the defence or the military identity, as if this was this big collective. And I think as practitioners, we of course have a notion, and also I have no doubt for those who have served and are serving, when I've had conversations with them, the idea that there's a single identity is quite, well, of course there isn't. And so even this paper, I don't think goes far enough as far as capturing the nuances. But certainly across the 65 studies that were included in it, what appeared to emerge was these themes. And yeah, that's where I developed the idea of a military identity model. And so we sort of see these identities that from the data, and a lot of qualitative studies made it into the scoping review, it was language around loyalty, language around being a warrior. And essentially those identities, there wasn't necessarily evidence to say they were the preferred identities, but certainly they're identities that align much better with the military culture. And so they do tend to confer more positive mental health benefits. We see resilience, we see pride, we see optimism. Whereas what we did also then see is, as you rightly pointed out, Jenna, is those hidden identities. And there were two components that I think are related that sort of stood out in that space. And one was around women serving in the military. And this sense of, in order to be accepted, having to perform twice as hard to be considered half as good was actually one of the quotes that I drew out. This sense of hiding femininity. Sorry, I'm falling over my words.
That's okay.
And the other interesting thing I think relating to that hidden identity was this sense that for women, they were sort of hidden within their military service. But also, really disturbingly, once they separated from the Defence Force and they may be wearing their medals on Veterans Day or Anzac Day here in Australia, and being challenged that they're wearing them on the wrong side of their chest, the assumption that they're not their medals, that they didn't serve. And that, through, I think, also as a feminist, through that lens, was really, on the one hand, confronting. And on the other hand, I know I've heard those stories myself. And then the other side that I don't want to separate, because the hidden identity also affects men, but it's that compartmentalizing of emotions. It's that sense that I can't show myself as an emotional being because it doesn't fit with that strong masculine military culture. And the consequences of having to hide or compartmentalize components like that, that's where we see, I think understandably, through our clinical lens, much more. Yeah, we see the impacts that happen on mental health. That sense of, I have to hide a part of myself, I have to suppress a part of myself. And so that speaks a lot more broadly, of course, to, I guess, patriarchal sort of structures and the like. And that's not the focus of my research, but it does speak to that culture and the challenges that exist in why the military exists and what we need of our service members versus the potential mental health impacts when people are suppressing.
I love that That complexity is part of this model because I think sometimes we can either oversimplify things, right? Like being in the military can be sometimes we oversimplify it to mean like, oh, they're so vulnerable to trauma, to isolation, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we kind of maybe jump to conclusions that being part of the military is like a risk factor for all sorts of mental health problems. On the other hand, we also see lots of really positive aspects of being part of the military culture that, like you were just saying, so that loyalty, that feeling of, part of something bigger than themselves and, and hard work ethic, all those kinds of things. And we almost, it's almost like it's this either or thing. And I love that it kind of incorporates all that together that, that there are going to be some aspects of somebody's identity that matches really well or maybe conforms really well with that military culture. And that may imbue some positive, maybe protective factors. And then there are some, aspects maybe that aren't as much as in alignment that may cause some vulnerabilities. And that can all be happening in the same person.
Absolutely. And I think because also through our clinical work, we tend to only see people also who are struggling in some manner.
Right.
And so it can also affect our lens to suggest that our service members all have mental health problems of some sort, which actually we know isn't accurate. When we look at the data, that's not the case. And so, what was really nice is to actually see, of course, there is this evidence that the military can be a very protective space, that it can absolutely provide that, I want to use the word family, that, and so thinking about culture, even as being a part of family. And so it can absolutely confer those positive benefits. It's the suppression of elements of ourselves, or when that identity becomes disrupted. That was the other really
The
interesting
last
part, I
category,
guess. Yeah. And so there were understandably a number of ways that it could be disrupted, but some of the key themes that stood out was the consequence of moral injury. And understandably, that's a space we're talking a lot more about now, which I think is
I would
fabulous.
say thankfully, yes, good, good.
Absolutely. That for too long we've just said it's PTSD, and that is too simplistic an understanding. And that isn't to take away from the PTSD diagnosis, but the complexities of moral injury. And so that was probably the largest number of studies, and it just speaks to how much in the last sort of, I guess it was across the last 9 years, we see this explosion of research into moral injury, which again, I agree is great. The other areas, of course, are those where the identity has been disrupted, usually due to mental health problems. And that's where we see that sort of internalized self-stigma, which is also, I guess, stigma being a component of the culture and the costs that come with that. And then the other was specifically related to PTSD and in the sense of deployment related PTSD, and that trend or theme, I should say, of being a failed warrior, that I've somehow failed. And I've certainly seen examples of that in my clinical work. And this really harsh juxtaposition between I've failed as a warrior because I have this diagnosis, but also totally being challenged by the fact that for so many of my clients, they don't think they deserve the diagnosis. They don't think they saw enough or experienced enough, or and so there's this real, I guess, identity conflict, and that's more from my clinical work rather than the research. But we can see how nuanced it is. And so, I guess there were other disrupted identities. The other big one, and I think is really important, is the lost identity. And that was post-deployment, but certainly post-discharge, separation from the military. And that sense of who am I? How do I fit in? What do I do now? And so some of that differed slightly, of course, whether it was post-deployment or post-separation, but there were certainly themes that overlapped in that area.
I wonder if related to the manner in which they separated too, like it was a medical discharge versus that, they were done with their obligation versus were dishonorably discharged, as we would call it here. Imagine that had an impact too.
Yeah. This research didn't specifically go into that, but I agree, Kevin. I would be very surprised that we wouldn't find that the method of discharge would have it would have a significant effect.
Well, I there's like five directions my brain is going at once, and it almost hurts. But as we're talking about some of these disrupted identities, and I was just thinking about some of these examples you gave, just in terms of loss of identity, and then Kevin's point, it kind of depends. We have a very poignant video of a service member, a Marine, who we have permission to show this video. It was collected. We did a military cultural competence, huge 8-hour course with the VA and the DoD, and we got to interview a lot of service members and veterans, one of whom was this Marine who was injured and had lost a leg and was still in recovery for that. And he just gives this beautiful, poignant, he tries to explain it to providers because we wanted it's about helping providers be culturally competent. He's like, imagine that you're a parent and you love this child with all of your heart and you want to protect it and you want to be there for it, and then you're told you can't, and you can't be there for them, and you can't even touch it. He's like, it's painful, it's heartbreaking, and it's like it just is absolutely beautiful. I'll have you watch it because I think you would love it. And I think, one of the things I want to talk about next, which is this isn't just research and figuring out identity. It has such implications for what providers can do and do differently. And I think, one of the things we always reinforce when we're teaching military culture is ask, don't assume, right? We never go in because we don't know what that service member's experience was
Their
and
identity.
how they identify or don't identify. And, have they been mortally injured or not? And are they leaving because they want to or because they didn't want to? Like, there's so many factors that come into play. People make weird assumptions about my service as a woman all the time. The only questions I ever get asked about was I sexually assaulted? Did I have sexual harassment? I'm like, what about all the awesome things I got to do in service, right? Like that, it's so interesting. But long-winded, I think one thing that I would love us to talk about are, this what are sort of like how can your findings impact provider practice? Like, are there any things you've got the mic that you would want to tell those providers listening, like, hey, I think this is how this is really going to help you in your work with military connected clients?
Yeah, I guess it was the really interesting space, isn't it, where you're doing a piece of research, and of course, what brought me into it was my clinical work and that interest. But then I'm doing a piece of research as a part of a PhD journey that's looking at the construction of identity. So very much qualitative social psychology. And then this question around, well, hang on, how do we translate this into something that as practitioners we can use? And as a practitioner, that is such an important thing. And so I guess that elements of it is, and I love that whole point about ask, don't assume, is that, yeah, I think it's around challenging a notion that everyone's experience is the same, that there's a one size fits all approach. And whether the military identity model can be used to inform health practitioners, like that's something that I would see utility. And so I'm currently working on a piece around how the military identity model or military identity and case formulation. And so I was
Yes.
trained in the 5 Ps model of case formulation. So the way in which we can think about the presenting problems through the lens of identity. And so how distress might be linked to role changes or status changes. So if somebody's injured and isn't able to perform their current role, we often think, of course, for anyone, civilians as well, that okay, there might be mental health impacts. But when I was doing my rehab work, most of my civilian clients who couldn't do their job, and I use job very, simply in this sense, but rarely was their identity impacted. Whereas for service members, when they're not able to perform their job role, the consequences and the far-reaching impacts as well, where postings might be impacted, promotions might be impacted,
Yes.
deployments certainly impacted. And so something like an injury, and it doesn't even have to be a significant injury, but the injury, what does that mean for the person's identity? I guess when we hear themes of people feeling that they're not fitting in or they're losing who I am, I think exploring that through the military identity lens. The other area I've certainly seen is working with members who are separating from defence and really fixating on the what they feel is the cultural divide between the values of civilians and the values of defence members. And I also see that post-deployment, I should say, but certainly I can think of one client where we did a lot of values work around how they can transition these military values
Yes.
into their civilian life and their civilian work roles, and the way in which that doesn't have to be in stark contrast to one another. And so I guess, yeah, it's about using military identity as a part of our formulations and really emphasizing how identity presentations could shift across career stages, but particularly circumstances, so where there might be those disruptions.
I
So that's some
love
of the
that.
area.
I love that, and I want you to sort of come up with a not a checklist, but like a, so we have we call them cultural vital signs in what we did, and it's kind of like good to ask questions around certain themes and topics, because I think we're as providers, we're trained in how do I assess for depression? How do I take this history? How do I do that? And a lot of times people don't know these good to ask questions. And I think something that we see so often is we hear these things like this loss of identity and this failed identity. And as behavioral health providers from our behavioral healthcare culture, which is very different from military culture, like almost diametrically opposed, we go in and we try to yank them over here and say, you did your service and you did your time and now you deserve to do other things. And what are your goals and what are, where are you headed without really understanding the values that they still hold from the military culture. And I loved how you said we work to think about how can I take these into this world versus like those don't serve you anymore, let go of them, right? Like, and I think that's part of the training with providers too, is how do I understand that this is such an important part of their identity and value that and honor that and figure out a way to bring it throughout the different paths in their life.
Yeah, I think so. Such an important thing, isn't it? And so it's that idea of what we were talking about before, that cultural safety is that idea of we wouldn't with another client sort of suggest, well, that's not applicable to you
Right.
anymore. But I guess the other thing is this idea that identity work is clinical work. And so it isn't a matter of let's focus on, oh, what am I seeing? Do I have 5 of 9 depression symptoms here? And that's not to suggest, of course, that we're not working within a model of care that does require the consideration of diagnoses. But it's appreciating that diagnosis through the lens of the client who's in front of us. And so certainly for practitioners who particularly haven't served, but I think it can also be salient for those who have served, who sometimes, you might see just through your own lens. But I think particularly for those who haven't served, yeah, it is that willingness to explore identity-related presentations, to understand the journey, those pre-military factors. So we might be considering predisposing factors, but we might be focused on family history and the like. And that's not to say that's not important, but also what drew this individual to the military? If we're
And what made
seeing,
them stay? Because sometimes what drew them in isn't what makes them stay.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And so, again, as I said, I'm trained in the 5 Ps model. So then I find myself thinking, okay, well, what triggered this? Was there an injury? Was there a downgrade? Was there some form of a disruption? Am I actually hearing persistent themes of suppression that are there? And then I think some of our perpetuating factors really is looking through that idea of there are very protective elements of military culture, and sadly, there are elements of it that actually maintain some difficulties that we might be seeing. And for our ex-serving members, sometimes it's that values work, for example, around that transition. We're not getting rid of that, but we're working out how that could exist in a greater harmony together. And then, of course, our protective factors. We've already acknowledged the military provides so many of them, but also exploring that through an identity lens, like in what ways does your military identity offer that protection, that strength of who you are, that even when disrupted, it doesn't mean that ceases to exist as well. So, yeah, that would be my hope, is that we can really look at this identity work as being clinical work. And exploring, I guess, overlaying the identities that we understand thus far, but really from a cultural safety perspective, drawing from our clients, help me understand what this means for you.
I really love that so much, the way you put that, because I think one of the things I have to remind myself in clinical work, and I think all of us do, is that my job isn't there to assess for and to treat a disorder. My job is there to work with this human being who's sitting in front of me, this individual, and to try to understand what's happening with them so we can work together on helping them achieve some goals. It's not about treating a disorder, it's about treating a person. It's so much connected with what you're saying, that this importance of seeing it through that identity lens. I wonder if we can, just looking at our time, I wonder if we can shift a little bit, because but it's re really, really related to what you're talking about here. And just this importance of recognizing individuals and where they're at, and kind of in many ways kind of like this, the importance of authenticity and how disruptive disruption to authenticity can be. I think Jenna mentioned earlier that this season our theme is, who's got your six? We're really focusing on, reminding ourselves, bringing, kind of to our minds, like, who's been there for us in the past? So the term "got your six" is about, kind of having your back. We talk about in the first episode of the season where the term seems to come from. But and we, just I wonder if you could share with us maybe an experience that you've had where, that you were facing some kind of adversity or some kind of difficulty, perhaps in your career, perhaps in your personal life, and somebody was there for you. They had your six, just as that reminder that, man, when things are tough, we've got resources to rely on.
Yeah, I found that a really interesting point. And so I was discussing it with my wife, and my wife actually has, she served herself and is still a current reservist. And
Very cool.
so, yeah, so the idea of who's got your six, like that wasn't something that was a foreign concept. But so we were discussing it, and of course there was discussion that it is, of course, her. Yes, you would be in trouble if you didn't say that. Yes, absolutely.
Understood.
but one of the things that struck me, and Jenna, you'd mentioned or you described it in a way also of creating a community we can lean on when needed. And so actually what really stood out is it's the team I work in currently. And so we exist within a broader team, but there's three of us. And I guess that we've developed a remarkably supportive network. And so what I would think of it is that we consistently look out for each other. We support each other's growth. We're working toward common goals. And that sense that we have each other's backs. And so I think it felt like that reflects in some ways for me the things I've observed from a military culture perspective. And
Absolutely.
so working in the university sector, there are certainly challenges, challenges to funding, challenges to workload, etc. And so having a team that you can just rely on for more than just your work decisions, yeah, that really stood out. And as far as my PhD journey, which is a little bit
Right.
encompassing at the moment, there's genuine excitement and encouragement for the research that I'm doing. And so, yeah, I guess when I thought
That's
about it,
great.
that was what stood out for me.
That's great. It's funny because we recently recorded our host version of this, and you're sort of really hitting on similar themes, and appreciate those examples and how important it is to, tend to those gardens, of those relationships that provide that for us. So, I really appreciate those stories. We are, I could talk about this for hours and hours and hours, but
Same.
I am aware that we're needing to wrap up. But before we do, we really love to leave our listeners with something we call actionable intel. And I wondered if you had a couple thoughts, and this can be resources or specific things they can do in their practice that will help them better integrate military identity and military culture into their case formulation and understanding. So any actionable intel you have on that front?
Yeah, I think, and some of the things that's come out and stood out in the conversation we've had today is that idea of look beyond the obvious. Yeah, so if something appears like a mental health problem in front of you, yeah, of course, but look beyond that obvious. Explore how role changes might affect identity. The other thing, and I know I found myself saying it, is how important cultural safety is in the work that we do. Military values aren't preferences, they're core identity elements. And then the other thing is that idea that identity work is clinical work. So spending that time exploring it, including identity exploration in our case formulations and treatment plans, just how important that is.
That those are fabulous, and I'm clapping and raising my hands. One of my favorite quotes, which is by William Osler, is, "It's much more important to know what sort of patient has a disease than what sort of disease a patient has." And I think that really our discussion today supports that tremendously. So want to thank you so much
Yes,
for
thank
taking
you.
the time to talk with us today. And I hope this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I have so many other questions I want to ask you and talk about, but thank you for your work and your dedication to this really important topic and for being with us here today.
So appreciate you sharing your time with us.
Honestly, not a problem. I've loved having this conversation. It's probably evident that I get a little bit excited in this area and talk quite a lot. But I've really enjoyed also having the opportunity to come on your podcast. And so thank you, I guess, is what I would say. And I too hope that this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, and happy to have many discussions around this space and hear your perspective. So, no, thank you.
Well, until next time, then, stay curious.
And mind your EVPs. Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.